KPBS On Demand is supported by UC San Diego's Art Power, presenting jazz musicians Nate Smith and Keon Harold, celebrating the birthday of John Coltrane, September 23rd at the Epstein Family Amphitheater. Tickets at artpower.ucsd.edu.
It's time for KPBS Midday Edition. On today's show, we'll hear from the authors behind this year's One Book, One San Diego selections. I'm Jade Hindman with conversations that keep you informed, inspired, and make you think. I'll talk with the adult selection author, James McBride, about his book, Deacon King Kong. Then the teen selection author, Tin Pham, about family style, memories of an American from Vietnam. Plus, Olivia Abtahi talks about her kids' selection book, The Interpreter. That's ahead on Midday Edition. You know, every year KPBS partners with libraries and other public institutions to bring you One Book, One San Diego. It's a time for San Diegans to share their love for reading by diving into the same book. There's a selection for adults, teens, and kids, and this year the teen selection is a graphic memoir. It follows a Vietnamese immigrant boy's search for belonging in America. And it is called Family Style, Memories of an American from Vietnam. Author, illustrator Tin Pham joins me now. Tin, welcome and congratulations to you.
Oh my God, thank you so much. This is so great because I've always kind of thought of San Diego as my second home. I'm really excited about it. I've been coming to San Diego Comic-Con every summer since 2000s.
Yeah.
And my friends live in San Diego, so I really love San Diego. And this is such an honor, and it's so awesome that it's in San Diego.
Oh, that's great. Sounds like you got some good history here.
Yes.
Well, okay, I can't wait to dive into your book.
Yeah.
Because this book really, it started with a conversation that you had with your mom back in 2020.
Yeah.
What was that like?
You know, it was really interesting because a lot of immigrant families, and whenever I do talks and I say this, a lot of Vietnamese immigrant people, if they're in the audience, they'll come up and tell me that it really relates to them. Because for us Vietnamese immigrants, a lot, our family always kept us from like trauma. They were always trying to protect their kids from anything that's bad. My parents has never told me anything like bad in our family, you know? And so my parents never told me the story, the full story of how we immigrated here from Vietnam. I mean, I would hear bits and pieces and stuff like that, but nothing, you know, fully detailed. And you know, I'm 48, so I've been around, so I haven't heard anything. And I've always wanted to tell this story because, like my friend Jin Yang, I once told my friend Jin Yang about kind of like how we came over to America. And my friend Jin Yang was basically like, you have to tell this story because it's the only thing interesting about you. And so I was like, well, I guess I got to tell it. But I never was able to do it. And I never really understood why until 2020, it was the pandemic. Basically, I went and visited my parents a lot because I was worried about them. And it was one of those things where you don't get to see people a lot, so you can visit your family and you can just sit outside in the backyard or the front yard and eat pho and talk. And I quickly realized that we were running out of things to talk about. So I decided that I was going to finally ask my mom. And so I asked my mom, the story. So she told me, but I wasn't really expecting how moved I would be. She told me this story. I think it maybe is my age. I'm starting to really think about things and life and stuff. And as she's telling me the story, I just felt so moved of the sacrifices and the hardships that my family went through just to give their kids a better life, you know? And I take my family, my parents for granted quite a bit. And when I heard this, I was just so, like, I just felt so, like, appreciative of their everything. And I was just like, I can't believe I was just complaining about having to, like, refix their Wi-Fi, and here they're telling me this story, this harrowing story of like everything they did to get us to have a better life. And so I went home and I was like, okay, I have to tell this story now. And so I just started to write.
Yeah.
And the weird thing was, even though I knew this from my mom, I didn't quite understand how to like approach the story until we had more of a conversation and my mom asked me what I remembered from my trip.
Well, let me ask you about that because, how does telling this story through a child's eyes resonate with teen readers? Why did you go that route with this?
Yeah. When I started writing this, I didn't really have an age group in mind. I was just, writing my parents' story. And when she asked me what I remembered, I started telling her the things I remembered about our early days in America. And I realized quickly that all my memories were from food. Like I had all these memories and every memory would start with, oh, I remember we ate this rice ball. Mm-hmm. I remember we had this thing. And that's when I realized that was like my approach to this project was I was going to be able to tell the story through memories of food. And I've already been kind of into, like for a long time now, I've been drawing a lot of comics about food. I do a comic strip food review every week with my friend Luke here at KQED, which is the public radio station we have here in San Francisco. So I've been working with KQED to do this food strip for a long time. And so it just perfectly matched. It's like, yeah, I'm going to tell it through my memories of food. And so as soon as that happened, I was able to just like really concentrate on writing this book. And the book became more like our story rather than just my parents' story, you know?
Yeah, that's cool. And talk to me about, you know, the graphic memoir format. I mean, what advantages does it allow you as a storyteller?
Oh, I mean, it's really great. This is my very first graphic memoir. And one of the greatest things about the graphic memoir is it allows, like, you remember your story. And if you don't remember your story, you have people that can reference it for you. The neat thing about everybody's life is, like, for a little while, I thought there had already been a couple of Vietnamese diaspora memoirs already and graphic novels, and they're really good. So for a while, I thought, do we need another one? And what I have come to realize after writing this book and going around and talking to other people that have read this book, that yeah, we need all these stories because it's like, I just didn't think that my life was anything that anyone wanted to read about. But in telling your story, it's amazing to see how many people can relate to your story. I have so many Vietnamese immigrants that you were either born here. There's a lot of second generation, third generation Vietnamese immigrant that tells me that their parents or their grandparents have the same story and how this is, you know, that they really relate to it. I have people that aren't even Vietnamese, just immigrants from the Philippines or, you know, and other countries that also relate to it. And then there's just people that just relate to it because of the food aspect or the or like certain aspects of being an immigrant. So it was really neat to see how my story is a very similar to many people's story. But the difference is what makes each one of them so interesting. You know, like someone will tell me, oh, my parents went through the same thing, but their story is this, this, and this. Mm-hmm. And it just makes me like, oh, wow, that's so super interesting, you know?
And what a blessing it is that you were able to hear about your story from your mother.
Yes.
And have that story to pass down. That's amazing. You know, this idea of the American dream is a really present theme throughout your book. How do you define the American dream, and has that changed at all?
You know, the American dream changed all the time, you know, for us, my parents and I. You know, when we used to think, you know, like as immigrants, you know, you want that house, that you want to be rich, you want to, you want your kids to be doctors and lawyers and engineers and stuff like that. And of course, that changes. Like not all of that is easy. Not all of that is, you find out, is actually what you want. You know, my parents were basically, they came with one thing, is that they were going to work hard so their kids can have a better life, you know. And I think they quickly realized that, you know, they can work as hard as you want, but, you know, and they can provide for their kids, but their kids had like minds of their own, you know. So like, it was really hard, like telling my parents that I wanted to be an artist, and I didn't want to get one of these jobs that they was like hoping that I would get to set me for life. So for the American dream, for me, it was different, right? I instead of trying to make a lot of money and have a solid foundation in life, I really wanted to just do art. I wanted to express myself. And so since my American dream changed, their idea of what the American dream did changed as well, you know. And as for a while, they worried a lot about me and us, because it wasn't exactly how they had pictured it. But now, you know, that they see, you know, how happy or what their kids are, I think they're way more flexible now. I think the American dream has changed quite a bit. I mean, I feel like my life now is living the American dream. I feel like we came here, my family came here with nothing, and we didn't know the language, we didn't know anything, and we worked hard to have good lives and to give back to this country that has adopted us, and to be a person that gives back and is integral part of this community. And I think I've done that, and I think I seek to constantly do that, and I think that's my American dream now, is to be part of something bigger, and that's what I look for.
That's great. You know, this book is the teen selection for One Book, One San Diego, but really anyone can enjoy it.
Yes.
What do you hope readers of all ages take away from the book?
I'm so happy that you say that, because when people ask me, that's kind of what I like to say. I think not only adults and teens will enjoy it, but I think little kids will enjoy it too. I've spoken to schools everywhere from like elementary schools all the way to middle schools and high schools and even adults. And I think it depending on what age you read it, you just get more out of it. You know, young kids, they like the story, but they might not grasp some of the nuances as a high school kid might grasp, and they might not grasp some of the themes that an adult reader might understand. And I was hoping that this book was one of those books that would just grow with people as they read it, you know. The two takeaways that I really wanted to come across, and it's not the thing that I started off telling, you know. I started off just telling the story about immigrants, but now I see it as a book about all of us, and about struggling to make it, and to being happy. And then I think with the immigrant part, I really wanted, one of the main things is I wanted to show the world how important immigrants are to this country. And how hard it is for them to work to become an integral part of this community. And it isn't something that you just, you know, fall into. It's something that you really, really have to work hard for. And I just really wish that everybody, when they read this, can see their family in this. I hope that more people, when they read this, look at their parents or the generation before them or before them, and see the sacrifices that every generation and the work that every generation does for the next generation.
Mm-hmm. Well, speaking of, you know, the next generation, I mean, I'm curious, do you have any concern that for people who may be seeking the American dream, You know, is it still attainable, or is it more difficult to attain now, you think?
I am a teacher now, and I have students that are immigrants as well. And I find that the American dream, it seems like it's something that is more widely available. I think that when we were growing up, what we wanted to do was very limited. You know, the idea of what you're going to be when you grow up was very limited. And now as I teach, I realize that when my students graduate high school and go to college and they get a job, their jobs are jobs that I don't even know about yet. You know, like I don't think that they are going to, you know, there are jobs that they're going to be doing that has not even been invented at this moment. And I like that. The world is moving way, way faster. And I feel like there's finally a place for everybody. You know, I feel like if you want to be an artist, you know, like when I was growing up, they would say, if you want to be an artist, there's no way you're going to starve. But now, if you want to be an artist, there's a place for you out there. You know, you can still be an artist and, you know, make money and survive. I feel like that world has been open to everybody. So I have like all the hope in the world that the kids of today, because how much the world has opened up, will have a better chance at, you know, achieving their dreams than we did.
I've been speaking with Tin Pham, author and illustrator of Family Style, Memories of an American from Vietnam. It's this year's teen selection for One Book, One San Diego. Tin, thank you so much.
Thank you so much.
Coming up, James McBride, author of the One Book, One San Diego adult selection, Deacon King Kong, joins us. KPBS Midday Edition is back after the break.
Hello, this is Dr. Michael Lalage, Medical Director and Chief of Staff for Kaiser Permanente San Diego. For more than 50 years, San Diegans have entrusted their health care to us. Our care and coverage connect to provide medical care tailored to each member. With our integrated network of primary and specialty care, we work together using evidence-based medicine to help deliver positive results. We believe in a healthy and engaged life with good beginnings and dignified endings. We believe that life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness requires total health, including equal access to high-quality, affordable health care. At Kaiser Permanente, our cause is health. Our passion is service. We work to help make lives better. To learn more, visit kp.org/San Diego.
Welcome back to KPBS Midday Edition. I'm Jade Hindman. To continue our celebration of International Literacy Day and One Book, One San Diego, James McBride is joining us. He's the author of this year's adult selection, Deacon King Kong, and he's really just a literary giant. Last year, McBride was awarded the Library of Congress's Prize for American Fiction. Aside from Deacon King Kong, some of his other works include The Color of Water, The Good Lord Bird, The Heaven and Earth Grocery Store, and much more. James joins me live now. Congratulations on the selection and welcome to Midday Edition.
Well, as they say in public radio, thank you for having me.
That is the thing they say, right? That's what we say.
That's what they tell you to say. They say, thank you for having me. All right, there it is.
Well, I'm so happy to have you here. You know, okay, so some readers, they may not know this about you, but you actually left a career in journalism to become a full-time musician. Talk to me about that pivot.
Well, I just got, you know, the nature of journalism is to find out what's wrong. And the nature of good storytelling that people want to read to the end, is to find out what's right and what works, you know. And so journalism for me was not creative enough. I just felt limited. And, you know, I grew up as a musician. I, you know, went to school for music. I loved play. So I quit. I was at the Washington Post and quit and moved to New York, moved back to New York and just started to play.
Wow.
And, you know, so those were happy years, actually. I was broke, but I was very happy. You know, you got to do what you like to do in this life, you know, because it's a very short run.
That it is. So. Yeah. Well, tell me, I mean, your first book, The Color of Water, was a memoir. How did you eventually land on fiction?
Well, I mean, The Color of Water was one of those things where, you know, you become the mixed race guy. Like, you know all about mixed race and anybody who's mixed and blah, blah, blah. I just find that to be pretty, for me personally, a little bit boring. You know, having grown up as a so-called mixed race person in Black America. I mean, if you can show me one Black American who's not mixed, I'll give you $100 right now. I've outgrown that, you know. And so fiction was a place for me to really, you know, a place where you could really make dreams come true, and you know, you could help things happen that you dream about and that have happened, and present them in ways that allow people to see how we learn to get along and how we are quite much a lot the same. So, and it's just more creative. I mean, nonfiction is you're limited by the facts, and sometimes those facts are someone else's facts. And you know, so then you get into like explaining why someone else's facts are not really facts. And by the time you finish, 10 pages have passed, and the reader puts the book down and turns on the television.
Sure, or starts to scroll, you know. I guess, you know, what you do gives you an opportunity to reimagine what this world can be and who people can be. You know, you once said in an interview, fiction allows your dreams to come true. In what ways has fiction made your dreams, both in the world of your novels and in real life, come true?
Oh, I don't know. I mean, you know, it allows you to be... I mean, you know, I'm working on a new book now, so I'm lost in that, and I don't feel like my dreams are coming true right now. I'm just going through the usual torture of book writing, but I mean, you know, it's provided me with a wonderful living, and I just got lucky. I mean, with fiction, you don't have to work with anybody else. Mm-hmm. If you're screenwriting, you write a production company. The production company says a little to the left, a little to the right, and then they stick the script in the drawer anyway because they want to keep their job. And then if you're in a band, or if you run a band, you say, look, I just want four bars of this, and they do something else because they're hearing something. You have to constantly coax others into your dream life. Mm-hmm. But with fiction, you know, you can. You don't actually move the characters around. They kind of move you around, but you at least set them on the page and you can turn them loose.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So, you know, you write because it chooses you, and fiction just chooses you, not the other way.
And when you write, there you don't have to make any compromises, which is a great thing. So let me get into your book, Deacon King Kong, here, because it's set in September 1969. Talk about the significance of that year and how New York changed during that time.
Well, you're talking to the wrong guy. I mean, I was just, you know, I was 12 years old, but I suppose, you know, it was a different city. I mean, it just was, you know, there were no cell phones. It was, you know, you had to talk to your neighbors. You had to really get along. You couldn't order from whatever it is people order from. I don't know. They have some, you know, you can just call somebody and they bring bread to your house or whatever. you know, it was just one of those, it was a situation where people had to actually talk to one another. And you know, it was a lot grittier. I won't say it was more dangerous. It was just more interesting, in my opinion. Now, you know, I don't want to get into the good old days. Everyone's good old days are worthwhile. But it was just a more interesting place because the dynamics of humanity, the dynamics of technology required that you stand at the bus stop and wait for the bus. You can do that now, but then you can check your watch and you can look at your cell phone. You don't have to look at people. You don't have to, you can just flow through as a lonely soul without ever paying attention to someone. You know, New York is like an empty disco. New York is like a disco now where just millions of people are dancing, being lonely together. In the old days, you know, you had to really communicate with other people because you were forced to just get around and, you know, go to the store and go to the park, and you had to You had to get out.
Right.
Now, that's not to say it's worse now than it was then. It was just different.
Yeah. And by different, there was human interaction. A lot more of it back then. That's such an interesting take. So the book follows Sportcoat, who is described as a cranky old deacon from a small Baptist church. One day he pulls out a .38 and shoots a drug dealer in front of everyone. It really causes a chain reaction in the community. So talk about the portrait you've painted of this community and how all their different worlds come together.
Well, you asked some pretty tough questions, you know. I mean, you ought to be a painter. I mean, I can't. Well, you know, essentially, this character is talking. This character the reader is visiting a world that I experienced as a child, and also that lives in every community in the country, and that everybody's different. And so you get to know the eccentric characters in your neighborhood, and you know the guy who works on his car all the time, and his aunt who takes out her teeth at Christmas, and all that other stuff. So the portrait of this community is usually the pretty stereotypical one, where you know people are shooting each other and stealing from each other, and da 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 da, and that's you know the cities are going to hell, and you know all that other stupid stuff. And that's not really true, not even now. You know, it's just a place of dynamics. And those dynamics, in my opinion, as a human being, but also as a creative person, are pretty interesting. So, because I like people, mm-hmm. you know, of all types. And so, you know, I try to give people a lot of space because they deserve it, just like I deserve my own. So, I don't know. I just tried to portray this community that is usually seen from behind the wheel of a locked car as the kind of place there where there's a lot of love, a lot of funny stuff happens, a lot of interesting stuff, and a lot of it's just based on humanity and nothing else.
Mm-hmm. And all of this takes place in a housing project in Brooklyn, similar to the one you grew up in. How did you draw on your upbringing for this story?
Well, I know a lot about the church. You know, my parents started a church in Brooklyn, a little tiny church, and I'm still part of that church. And so, you know, I knew a lot about, you know, I knew a lot about a lot. I know a lot about the community because I participated and still participate in it. So that part wasn't, you know, hard to draw on. I mean, if you're a writer, you better be around somebody. You know, you can't just sit on a beach in Maui and write books. I suppose you can, but I just can't do it myself. But I know people can do it. I mean, Elmo Leonard wrote great books, and he wrote books about all kinds of stuff. And he said he just read magazines, but I'm just not that smart. So, I just did it. You know, everybody sings the song the best way they know how to sing it. With whatever music they have. So for me, presenting this community was, and some of it was very joyous because I love some of the characters in the book.
Sure.
You learn to forgive your tribe more than someone else's tribe. But the truth is, your tribe's no better than anybody else's. And if you approach a story like that, then you learn to get the best out of everything. There was a writer in New York named Pete Hamill. He was a wonderful, wonderful guy, and he was a wonderful writer. He was an Irish-American cat, you know. And I used to talk to him. I knew him, you know, until he died. I mean, I would talk to him about writing and about New York. And Pete was the kind of guy who really understood that people are just trying to do their best. Mm-hmm. And he saw a lot of bad stuff. I mean, he was a journalist for a long time. He was a very gifted journalist. But he always understood that people are trying to do their best. And that made him, in my opinion, a great, I don't know, I'd say a role model, a person to think about in terms of, you know, these characters. And in this particular situation, because Pete grew up not too far from where my housing project is. He grew up in the Gowanus area, which was, in those days, mostly, you know, working class, Irish, Latino, et cetera, black, blah, blah, blah.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and, you know, so that's, I don't know if I'm just rambling now.
Well,
I
mean, hey,
you gotta stop.
Listen, you draw off of these relationships and even just passing conversations that you have with people when you're bringing your creativity to the pages of a book. And speaking of which, I know you've sort of had your mind in the pages of your next book, but it's been 5 years since Deacon King Kong came out. How are you looking back on this story now in 2025?
Well, you know, part of you is like Willie Nelson, who said, you know, if they ask me to sing to all the girls I've loved before one more time, I'm going to throw myself out the window. Well, so, I mean, something to that effect. So, I'm still active in my community that is reflected in that book, you know, some 40 years ago. And the community has changed quite a bit. And the problems that exist in the community now, some of them are the same problems that existed before, and some of them are not. I mean, in 1969, you know, in the housing projects in Brooklyn, there were a lot more families with fathers who worked, who had jobs, you know. And here in this year, you know, fathers are a rarity because so many of them are either sick or in jail. And, you know, health, just the health problems
mm-hmm.
of community now are far more significant than they ever were when I was a child. You know, and the food supply, all that mm-hmm. stuff, it's really more complicated and requires a lot more time and a lot more thought. But the compassion and love is the same. You know, the population has changed somewhat, a lot more Chinese now in the projects, at least in my, you know, my housing project. But, you know, they too suffer. The poor suffer in this country. I mean, I was very interested to hear your young, the young man who was talking before you. He sounds like a very talented writer, but I disagree with his last comments about, you know, opportunity for immigrants. I don't mm-hmm. believe that's happened. But, you know, he's a young guy and we need his voice. I see a little different take about, you know, in terms of how we treat the poor and working poor in this country.
Yeah.
So in some ways, Deacon King Kong, as you know, as twisted and screwed up and as funny and as humorous as the community was, there is a lot of that still. There are still good cops who are really funny and who really do their best, and there are really good churches and good people in church who really try hard, and they don't use religion like a baseball bat. There's all that, but there's also, you know, this giant militaristic, you know, hovering over you with the cameras and the, you know, these, you know, just the whole mentality of we're not watching out for you, we're watching over you. And that didn't exist in 1969.
Well, you know, I know you're going to be bringing this book, Deacon King Kong, to San Diego. So briefly, as we wrap up, what do you hope readers in our region take away from it?
Well, I hope they buy the hardcover so I can get a new car. That's what I hope. No, I'm just kidding. I mean, you know, be joy, love somebody, you know, be courageous and make change right where you are. I mean, the character in this book, you know, he makes changes right where he is,
mm-hmm.
you know, and so you make change right where you are. Take a stand. Be courageous. Stop being afraid. Yeah. What's there to be afraid about?
All right.
No gun is going to protect you in this world. Just, you know, put God in your lap and roll.
That is a good message. I've been speaking with James McBride, author of the 2025 One Book, One San Diego Adult Selection, Deacon King Kong. James, it's been a real pleasure to talk with you. Thank you so much and congratulations again.
All right. Well, thank you for having me.
Still to come, Olivia Abtahi talks about her kid selection book, The Interpreter.
I like writing books about the things that we don't talk about, the things that a lot of children just assume is normal.
KPBS Midday Edition is back after the break.
Hi, I'm Dr. Rachel Jans, Associate Curator of Modern and Contemporary Art at the San Diego Museum of Art. We're presenting a landmark exhibition of Eduardo Chiida, a visionary sculptor who transformed the way we think about form, space, and material. Eduardo Chiida, Convergence, is the most expansive U.S. presentation of the artist's work in nearly 50 years, bringing together monumental sculptures, delicate works on paper, and a virtual reality experience of his iconic Comb of the Wind installation on the Basque coast of Spain. Eduardo Chiida Convergence is on view now through February 8, 2026 at the San Diego Museum of Art in Balboa Park. Learn more at sdmaart.org.
Welcome back to KPBS Midday Edition. I'm Jade Hindman. This hour, we're talking with the wonderful authors of One Book, One San Diego, the annual literary program where San Diegans enjoy the same book. Next up is the children's category. This year's selection is called The Interpreter. The book follows a young soccer player who's an interpreter for her Spanish-speaking parents. It's available in both English and Spanish. And joining me to talk about it is Olivia Abtahi. Olivia, welcome to Midday Edition.
Thanks so much for having me.
So glad to have you here. So your book follows the story of Cecilia. She has two jobs, one on the soccer field and one at home as a translator. Tell me about her.
Yeah, Cecilia is like a lot of kiddos here in the United States. She has parents who speak mostly Spanish. So she kind of has this secret second job where she is interpreting all of her English world into Spanish for her parents.
Ah, well, I'd love to have you read a couple of lines for us to really get a sense of the story. Do you have something?
Yes. So I will be reading from what I like to call the montage scene in the picture book. And it's just a series of vignettes where Cecilia is translating just kind of everyday interactions for her parents. So I'll start right here at the grocery store where Cecilia's father asks, ¿De dónde son estos mangos? Where are the mangoes from? What'll it be, folks? ¿Qué quiere pedir? ¿En cuántos días llega? When will a package get there? And now we come across a family with another little interpreter, and they ask in Persian, ¿En cuchuluye shema chan salishe? And that mother's interpreter asks Cecilia, how old is your little one? Cecilia then relays that message to her mother and says, ¿Quieren saber la edad de la bebé? Now we see Cecilia, she's getting more and more tired. For service in Spanish, press 3. And Cecilia says, marque el 3. Lastly, ¿qué significa at your earliest convenience? And Cecilia, looking so exhausted, says, lo más pronto posible. So we've got all of these different moments. My favorite is when they say for service in Spanish, press 3, but they're saying it in English. And we've all been there and we have to say, mom, like press 3.
Well, you know, that portion of your book, I mean, it really is the experience of a lot of children. An estimated 11 million children in the U.S. are interpreters or translators for their parents. And that's according to the U.S. Census Bureau. What made you want to write a story for these kids?
I selfishly wanted to write the story for myself. I grew up in a household where my father is Iranian and my mother is Argentinian. So we had languages just kind of flying all over the place. And it wasn't really until I became older that I realized, oh, like this was not a normal experience for every family. I had parents who did learn English in their home country. So they learned a very kind of anglicized form of English. Mm-hmm. But when it came to just Americanisms and idioms, there were things that I remember translating. And at the time I felt shame about it. And we just didn't talk about it. And I like writing books about the things that we don't talk about, the things that a lot of children just assume is normal, but turns out it's not everybody's experience. So I really just want to write this for myself And then it, you know, as it went on and on, I'm realizing that I'm not the only one. And it helped me feel less alone in writing this novel and seeing all of these other children have the same experience.
Yeah. Well, you tell this story with a lot of playfulness and humor. Cecilia takes her job very seriously. She wears an oversized green suit and tie. So why was that playfulness really a priority for you?
I always want to talk about hard things with playfulness. A lot of times when children are going through difficult things or trauma or just something really tough, you know, rarely will a child say, "Help, help, I'm being oppressed. You know, help, help, this is too much." And I always think about that when I'm reading heavy picture books. And those are the kinds of books where my daughter will lose interest, where we'll be reading and it's like, like this is a drag. And they're important books. Don't get me wrong. They're important with a capital I. They're the kind of books that win awards, but are they the kinds of books that a child will want to read over and over again? So playfulness is super important to me because at the end of the day, this is for children. And I think when you add playfulness or lightness to difficult subjects, I'm not trying to make it more palatable, but I do want it to be something that is easier for children to process and see happening in their own lives as well.
So, you know, I mean, in what other ways do you really strike that balance when it comes to covering some of those heavier and more difficult topics?
I really struggled with this manuscript, to be honest. It was really hard. The first versions were that kind of insipid heaviness that I mentioned. You know, full of lessons and morals. And I think what really helped me was actually my background is in film and television. I went to NYU film school. And when I finally just sat down and wrote this manuscript as a screenplay, where I could see what is happening on the page versus what is happening in the text, that helped me a lot in striking that balance and envisioning colorful characters saying these things. You know, it's one thing to stare down the barrel of a Word document just in black and white, but it's another to imagine in your head, okay, like there's going to be pinks and purples and blues and greens on this page. How can we walk that fine line between an important message, but also just having a really appealing and lighthearted book?
Well, the wonderful illustrations in this book are done by Monica Arnaldo. How are colors and imagery really used to carry the story forward?
Monica is a complete genius. And I do want to add that she also grew up in the same kind of household as this book, where we were both little interpreters. And I think that adds so much. The montage scene that I just read out loud for you, that was all Monica. Much of that was not in my manuscript. And she wanted to add some experiences that she had had growing up as a Mexican Canadian. And Monica's colors and use of the page, the visual balance really comes to light with the speech bubbles. We have all of the speech bubbles in different colors according to the different language. So here in the manuscript, we've got all of the Spanish in a kind of orangey yellow and all of the English in blue. And so when we have moments where those two languages are intersecting, that creates green. So you've got this really gorgeous Venn diagram, and there's sections in Persian. Those are in pink. When those join with the blue, that makes purple. And on top of that, taking from those colors, Monica has given Cecilia a green suit because she is speaking both the yellow Spanish and the blue English. And so what's wonderful about this suit as well, and once again, this just speaks to Monica's brilliance, is that in the beginning of the manuscript, Cecilia is wearing kind of an ill-fitting suit. You know, it's a little big. She's trying to fill some shoes that are a bit too big for her. But as she gets more and more exhausted, the suit takes on a mind of its own. It gets longer. The tie gets longer. The collar becomes rumpled. It becomes wrinkly. And it is kind of this visual metaphor for Cecilia's exhaustion as this poor suit gets worn out. And later towards the end of the book, as Cecilia claims more agency, the suit becomes really snappy, well-fitted, and Cecilia just looks really sharp.
Yeah, I love that. You know, this book, it really does have to do with first-generation kids having to take on these adult roles and the immense pressure they can feel. Talk to me about the emotional weight of that, as illustrated in the book.
Yeah. For a lot of first generation kids, this sense of obligation, duty, filial piety really weighs on us. We know that a lot of our parents came from situations that were really difficult in their home countries. And so having parents who brought us here with so much opportunity is kind of instilled in us. It's just this unspoken thing. And I think the suit also kind of shows that weight on Cecilia, because we would never say like, no, I can't translate your coffee order. Like I'm burnt out. It's like, my parents have sacrificed everything to bring me here. We're so lucky we can even go to a coffee shop and have our customized order. Why would I not translate it for them? So I think, once again, it's that balance of importance and playfulness, having to show visually how this duty and obligation can kind of like weigh children down was really important without making it too heavy.
Yeah. Well, you know, as we mentioned, this book is the children's selection for San Diego's One Book, One San Diego. It'll be available in both English and Spanish. As readers bring this story home, what do you hope they take away from the book?
Well, it's so wonderful that, first of all, One Book, One San Diego picked this book because, as an Iranian Argentinian, there is a huge Persian and Latina population in San Diego. So I'm hoping that kiddos who look like me, as they're reading this book, will see, hey, I'm not the only one. This is something that other children are experiencing too. First of all, there's no shame. This is very normal for a lot of families. And secondly, I hope that they just start the conversation of how it feels for them. Some kids may really enjoy this, but at the end of the day, translating is a full-time job. And some children might be really overwhelmed. So I hope that this book gives children courage to ask for help, number one, but to just even show this labor in the limelight. It's just so unspoken. It's just so assumed that, you know, kids will help in this way. And I love that, you know, so many children want to help their families. But I do just want to shed light on the fact that this is a full-time job that a lot of kiddos are doing in addition to their very real job of being a kid. And I hope that this book just starts conversations, and that if there's children who need help, that they know that it's okay to ask.
I've been speaking with Olivia Abtahi. She's the author of the picture book, The Interpreter. It's the children's selection for One Book, One San Diego. Olivia, it's such an important book. Thank you so much for taking the time to talk to us, and congratulations.
Thank you so much.
That's our show for today. I'm your host, Jade Hindman. Thanks for tuning in to Midday Edition. Be sure to have a great day on purpose, everyone.
KPBS On Demand is supported by Paint Care, offering households and businesses in California more than 800 leftover paint drop-off sites for recycling. Quantities of 100-plus gallons of paint may qualify for a large volume pickup. Learn more at paintcare.org.